For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, Chris Lintott discusses The Sky at Night and the astronomical power of the Zooniverse.
I had a wonderful tweet from somebody who'd encountered the project and whose five-year-old wouldn't go to sleep last night because she was classifying galaxies.
Jane Clark introduces me to some awesome egg experiments.
Can you feel that, Red?
Oh, yes, it's really blowing up.
That's blowing up,
absolutely.
And you can no doubt smell this is something you do want to do over the sink.
And actor Robin Commode has some surprising advice for improving your public speaking. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Chris Lintott is an Oxford Professor of Astrophysics and the co-presenter of The Sky at Night. He's also the principal investigator of the Zooniverse, the world's most successful citizen science project. His new book, The Crowd and the Cosmos, Adventures in the Zooniverse, describes the astronomical contribution ordinary people and their computers are making to scientific research.
Andrew Gray is a car mechanic who lives in Darwin in northern Australia. He's also an amateur astronomer, with a collection of telescopes used for stargazing under the clear desert skies. And in April 2016, he was the first person to realise that J23154776-1050590 was a star worth keeping an eye on. Every so often, the star does something odd. It winks, dimming slightly for an hour or two. These winks reveal the presence of something that would otherwise be hidden. They're caused by the regular passage of a family of planets that happens to cross, or transit, the face of the star as seen from Earth.
Chris Lintott narrating his new book, The Crowd and the Cosmos, Adventures in the Zooniverse. Keen to learn more myself, I invited him to the RNIB studios. Chris Lintott, welcome to Read On.
It's wonderful to be here.
For those who don't know about the Zooniverse, can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. The Zooniverse came about as, you know, an everyday solution to an everyday problem. We just had too many galaxies to deal with, which many people face in their lives. In our case, we had images of a million galaxies. And if you want to understand a galaxy, you want to sort it out by shape. You want to distinguish a nice, beautiful spiral like our own Milky Way from essentially those which are just big balls of stars, which we call elliptical galaxies. And you have to do this by looking at the data. We had a student look at 50,000 of these galaxies. He showed that he was better than a computer, but he'd had enough after 50,000. And so without really thinking about it, we put the images online on a website called Galaxy Zoo and invited people to come and help. And to my great surprise, we had hundreds of thousands of people helping in the first day, providing 70,000 classifications of galaxies an hour.
Wow.
And the public turned out to be very good at this. So Zooniverse is a collection of projects like that. We discovered that other scientists studying everything from cells to penguins have similar problems. They have too much data and not enough people to sort through it. And so we have this army of nearly 2 million people online helping scientists and other researchers discover what's out there in their data sets.
So it really is a perfect marriage of technology and human beings.
Yes, there's something nice about the fact that it's the technology that caused this problem in the first place. I think if we want to be slightly hyperbolic about it, for the first time in human history, our understanding of the universe is limited not by how much data we have, how much we can collect, but what we do with what we've already got. And so the same digital technology that caused the problems, that created these large data sets, can solve it by connecting us to crowds of people who are happy to give up their spare time and try and make a contribution.
And reading your book, I was really struck by what a deluge of data there is coming in, just how many observational experiments are going on at the moment, how many pictures are being produced that need to be interpreted by somebody or something.
That's right. I mean, it's true in my area of astrophysics, but one of the great joys of Zooniverse and of writing the book was getting distracted by all the other areas as well. I think the best example of this is my friend Tom, who describes himself as a penguinologist, which is officially one of the world's top 10 great job titles, I think. But Tom is interested in penguin colonies in the Antarctic Peninsula, the bit that sticks up towards South America, and he's interested in the penguins' response to climate change, to fishing, to tourism, and to the presence of scientists like Tom as well. And he used to go every year to the same sites and he'd stand there and he'd count the penguins. But he discovered that he could buy very cheap hunting cameras designed for lazy hunters in the United States who want to know what's in their backyard. And with a car battery and a bit of jury rigging, these things exist and last throughout a winter, taking images every hour. And so Tom can now see the penguins arrive, nest, interact, and get a much richer sense of what's going on. But there's still only him. He can go around all the sites once a year, come back, change the battery, come back with the memory card. But he comes back to Oxford each year with about 8 million images of penguins. And he still only has one student.
Yeah, which I guess is more pictures of penguins than has ever been produced before.
That's right, and more penguins than you'd expect as well. That team found a million extra penguins last year, which they found by the smell. One of the things I do want to make sure people understand, because I got to go to the Antarctic with Tom, and for an astronomer it was a bit of a rude shock. Penguins smell awful. People think of them as little cute cartoon characters, but they're disgusting creatures. Awful, awful things.
The same citizen science is being used also for maritime history and for decoding papyri, I believe.
That's right. We sort of stumbled into all sorts of areas because researchers would just phone up and ask whether our volunteers would be interested in their projects. One of the first ones we did was one called Old Weather, which is a collaboration with the Met Office. I think my American colleagues were a bit confused by the name Old Weather, but of course I think there's something British about caring about that stuff. If you want to understand climate change, you need to test the computer models, which predict what the weather's going to be like. And the best way to test those is to predict the past. And if you can get the past right, that you can be confident that you can predict the future. But we need more records from the past. We were okay for most of the 20th century, but our friends at the Met Office had realised that the Royal Navy for a long time has instructed its ships, literally come hell or high water, to record the weather every 4 hours. And so volunteers went through the logbooks from, first of all, from the First World War, though we've gone back before that now, and rescued all of this weather data. And that was an interesting project because we got the scientific data we wanted. We now have a much better understanding of what the weather was like around the globe in the early part of the 20th century. But the volunteers sort of didn't care about the weather. They got interested in the history of these things and found all sorts of serendipitous discoveries in the logbooks. It's one nice example. Well, we know where a bucket was thrown overboard from one particular ship. No one's gone to get it yet in the middle of the Atlantic. There was a ship which lost all of its chocolate rations on loading, which inspired all sorts of poetry and so on. And then there was this one senior officer who kept popping up on ship after ship after ship. And the volunteers got very interested in this guy and tracked him. And it turned out his only role was to turn up and give medals to people. So he was a morale officer. And they found him hopping around the Atlantic in 1915 and 16.
And this is exactly where the human input comes in so important, because it's those quirky little things that capture the imagination of human beings that might be missed by a sort of bubble sorting artificial intelligence program.
That's right. I think a way to put it is that humans are brilliantly distractible. And I think we know that in our everyday lives. But this turns out to be very useful when you're looking at scientific data. I think there are good examples in astronomy where, for example, the Dutch schoolteacher Hanny van Arkel, who was an early participant in the Galaxy Zoo project, we showed her a particular picture of a galaxy. There was a sort of a blurry spiral galaxy, and an algorithm might, if it was having a good day, tell you that that was a spiral. Hanny noticed there was this blob, this blue blob sitting underneath it, which she called the Voorwerp, which we thought was a technical term, so it's in the literature as Honey's Voorwerp, and it was only later we found out this is the Dutch word for thingy or object. But the Voorwerp turned out to be sort of a galaxy-sized cloud of gas. We end up pointing all sorts of telescopes at it and discovering it was energized by activity around the black hole at the center of the other galaxy. And looking at the Voorwerp has become a way of understanding how black holes like that change and evolve. Honey became a bit of a celebrity on Dutch television. We flew her to a conference of astronomers, and eminent professors lined up to meet the Hanny van Arkel. And so other volunteers started spotting their own Voorwerpen, which turns out to be the plural. You learn all sorts of things in this game. And this is now a new way of studying galaxies. But we didn't even know to look for those things. We wouldn't have asked an algorithm the right question. But because, as human beings, we're good at doing one task and getting distracted, we get that serendipitous discovery sort of for free if we can interact with volunteers this way.
So for any of our listeners who haven't yet taken part, because this is open to everyone, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah.
You know, the only thing we're giving up is a few hours of our time, or maybe even just a few minutes of our time. So how would we get involved?
Well, the easy thing to do is just to go to zooniverse.org and pick a project. We make sure that most of them are tested so that we know that if somebody spends only a few minutes on the project, then they will be useful. And while they're mostly visual, there are some sound projects. There's a project called Bat Detective, which is run out of University College London, where they have actually volunteer collected audiograms of bat sounds and calls. And the task is to identify both the species, but also whether the bats are talking to each other or feeding or navigating. And it's quite fun to imagine these creatures and to recognise what they're doing in their sounds.
What first got you into the world of astronomy? Were there specific discoveries that you heard about on the news that fired your imagination?
I think I'm quite unusual for a professional astronomer because I grew up looking at the night sky. Most of my colleagues are distractible physicists or mathematicians who've sort of wandered in. But I was a kid who went outside and looked up at the sky. And I think there were a few things that really kicked off my interest. One was the remarkable events when a comet called Schumacher-Levy 9 hit Jupiter, and it was seen on the way in the string of cometlets, which is the word for bits of comet, which I like, hit Jupiter one by one, and the impacts were on the far side as seen from the Earth, so we couldn't see the flash directly. But people had speculated that this would leave a mark on Jupiter's atmosphere, but no one really knew what to expect. Nothing like this had been seen in the few hundred years since the invention of the telescope, and I remember getting my own tiny telescope out in suburban Devon, looking at Jupiter on after the first crash. You could see there was this bullseye, this black eye on the planet, and that was amazing, to have seen an event that was unique and interesting, predicted, and then see the effects really hooked me. And another part of the puzzle was that my school was lucky enough to have an observatory, which was great, and more to the point, they gave the 13-year-old kids who were interested keys to the observatory. So we were trusted with the telescope. We also discovered you could get pizza delivered to the observatory, which was hugely attractive. But just the idea that we'd been trusted with this piece of equipment and we could try to do science with it, I think for me that kept my interest alive through a school science curriculum that's quite dry, quite textbooky, mostly about received knowledge. I was out in the observatory eating pizza and trying to discover something or find something new.
Yeah, real hands-on science.
Yes.
And that, of course, led you eventually to the sky at night and to working with the great Patrick Moore.
Yes, well, that was the privilege of a lifetime. I, like so many other people, wrote a letter to Patrick when I was a kid, and we corresponded a bit while I was a teenager. I've kept a few of the postcards I got back. My favourite just says, "Chris, yes, haste, Patrick." By the time it arrived, I had no idea what the question was, but he was good at staying in touch with people like this. And I was lucky enough to fall into the sky at night as a researcher and then as a reporter and presenter. Working with Patrick was fascinating. He was a larger-than-life character. He was exactly the same off-screen as he was on-screen. But he had this ability to convince his audience that they were going to understand what he said. When Brian Cox or I say we're going to tell you about black holes, I'm pretty sure half the audience says, "Oh, I never understand this stuff." When Patrick says we're going to tell you about black holes, people believed him and they would lean in and listen, and I think we've been trying ever since to try and keep hold of that on the sky at night.
It's really got an enduring appeal. It's been running for what, 50 years now?
We're coming up, we're not far off the, yeah, let's see, 55, so we're not far off the 60th anniversary. It's coming up quickly. I think the appeal is that it's just straightforward people talking about their science, and scientists getting excited about things, I think, is excellent. Even if you don't understand why Johnny Nichols from Leicester cares about the plasma atmosphere of Jupiter, you can see him jumping around while the Juno spacecraft arrives. If you don't understand why Anna Horleston from Bristol wants to know about earthquakes on Mars, you could see that she's excited as the InSight probe landed this time last year. I also think astronomy's lucky in that the questions we ask as researchers, how did it all begin? Is there life out there? What's the history of the Earth? Those are things that everyone's interested in. My research questions are the same things I get asked in the pub. That's probably not true if you're a condensed matter physicist, for example. Whereas for an astronomer, I think there is that attention.
And there does seem to be a genuine sense of progress and understanding being made. There are new discoveries being made almost on a monthly basis in the news. we might not necessarily understand them entirely, but it does feel as if understanding is growing.
That's right. I grew up, as I said, as a kid, interested in astronomy and looking at space, and I was a bit wistful, I think, at the time that I'd missed the Apollo landings, because the people of the generation above me talk, and many of your listeners might remember watching that first small step and think of that as the golden age of spaceflight. Well, we're now in the golden age of astronomy. So not traveling to out into space, but in terms of understanding the cosmos, things are moving very rapidly. One way of seeing that is that this year's Nobel Prize went partly to Didier Queiroz and Michael Mayer, two scientists who discovered the first exoplanet, a planet around a star other than the Sun. We have a project called Planet Hunters, where people can either view or actually listen to the changes in brightness around a star, and you could discover a planet from your web browser. So in 20 years, we've gone from Nobel Prize winning science to something you can manage to do in a lunchtime without any prior training. And I think that gives you some idea of how fast things are changing.
Yes, it's not some poor chap in an observatory praying for a cloudless night.
Oh, they're
anymore.
Still there. Then they share their data with the rest of us. So that's the difference.
From the Sky at Night, you and Patrick Moore and Brian May wrote a fantastic book called Bang, The Complete History of the Universe, which is actually in the R&IB Talking Books library.
Oh, good. I didn't know that. That's great.
That must have been great fun to work on.
It was fun. It was also, I think, a few publishers lost most of their hair during that process. So it was Patrick's idea to write this book, it's a history of the universe in order. So we start with the Big Bang and we work forwards, which I don't think had been done before. And Patrick recruited Brian and myself, and both of us said that we'd love to help but didn't really have time. And 2 weeks later, an 80,000-word package from Patrick, typed out on his typewriter, arrived on the doorstep. Now, not much of that is in the book. We used to gather at Patrick's house for the weekend, spend 6 hours trying to find Patrick's cat, which was very important, and then we'd go through and rewrite it painstakingly so that it sounded like all three of us and that it was accurate and up to date and so. But we were essentially held hostage. Every time we said we were out of time, Patrick would just threaten to publish his version. And so it was a proper collaborative project. And Bang, I think, is rather wonderful. The only problem with the idea turned out to be that all the hard stuff is at the beginning. So if any of your listeners have got through the first 20 minutes, keep going. You get inflation and quantum cosmology and all that stuff at the beginning of the universe. By the middle, it's planets and aliens and life and all of that stuff. So you've got to persevere through the cosmology.
Your own book, The Crowd and the Cosmos, you've narrated it yourself, which is always lovely to have the author narrating the audiobook copy.
Yes, I have. It was a slightly chastening experience, I think. It's an interesting thing. I was in a tiny studio, even smaller than the one we're in now, actually, for 3 mornings reading it, and it was wonderful to be able to do that. But I did realise, I think, the number of people who listen to the audiobook is so large now. I think if I write anything again, I will think audio first and make sure that what I'm writing is speech, essentially, rather than intended for the page. When somebody did say that the experience of reading the book was like having me on a particularly enthusiastic night out sitting opposite them in the pub and talking and talking and talking. So maybe some of that comes through as well.
Did you manage to keep your hands to yourself?
Oh, definitely not. No, my hands are all over the place, as ever. I've always thought with my hands. And there's plenty of that in the audiobook as well. I've just learnt not to hit the microphone.
As the principal investigator of the Zooniverse, what do you hope is going to be the next great discovery made by
citizen scientists I'm not quite sure that's the right word. Everyone taking part in these projects is just a scientist to me. On the way here, I had a wonderful tweet from somebody who'd encountered the project and whose 5-year-old wouldn't go to sleep last night because she was classifying galaxies, which I thought was rather wonderful. But the next discovery, well, we've just put new data into Planet Hunters. So I would very much like, and that's from a NASA satellite called TESS, which is looking at the sort of whole sky and looking for exoplanets. So I'd love to have Planet Hunters find a planet in orbit around a star that I can point to in the night sky. At the minute, we mostly know planets around fainter stars, but we're getting to the point where we can find them around naked eye stars as well. So I'd love to be able to, with a telescope, look at a star and say, yes, there's a planet around that discovered by a volunteer. So that would be really exciting. The other thing that's changing is that we have new data coming. So new telescopes were providing ever more data, and we're going to have to get better at sorting through them if we still want to be able to be surprised by the unusual.
I'll keep my ears open for news from the Zooniverse Coalface. And Chris Lintott, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Because of the vast distances involved, when we look at the stars, we are taking part in time travel without any need for a Wellesian machine or Doctor Who's TARDIS. Consider Sirius, which is the brightest star of the night sky and is very conspicuous for several months in each year. It is 26 times as powerful as the Sun and 8.6 light-years away, that is to say, roughly 50,000 billion miles. Its light takes 8.6 years to reach us, so that if we look at it in the year 2000, we are actually seeing it as it used to be in 1999. The pole star, Polaris, which many people, certainly all navigators, can recognise, is about 400 light-years from us, according to the latest measurements. The light we see coming from it right now left Polaris around 1606. And any astronomer there, equipped with a sufficiently powerful telescope, could look at the Earth and see England as it used to be in the time of Shakespeare. The light now reaching us from Rigel started on its journey towards us in the time of the Crusades. And even this is local by the standards of the universe as a whole. We can now study objects that are so remote that we see them as they used to be long before the Earth existed. This time travel is essential for our understanding of the universe.
Raymond Sawyer narrating Bang, The Complete History of the Universe by Patrick Moore, Brian May and Chris Lintott, which is TB16127. The Crowd and the Cosmos is out now in hardback, ebook and audio, and Bang, The Complete History of the Universe, is available in Braille and as TB16127. And Chris will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show: could squeezing your bum help you make a speech? But first, and with science still fresh in our minds, Jane Clark's Egg Experiments was one of the highlights of this year's Summer Reading Challenge for children. It's the first book in a science-based adventure series aimed at 7 to 11-year-olds, and it's packed full of try-this-at-home fun. With two more books in the series being added to the library, it was time to meet their author. Jane Clark, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here, Red.
So Al is a fearless and intrepid scientist. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, Al is very much based on my son, Andrew. When he was about 8, and he was absolutely science mad, and he loved doing experiments in the house that made an awful lot of mess. So the worst one that I remember was when he was using his model cars, his little matchbox cars, to see how fast they'd go over different surfaces. And he decided to spread cooking oil all over the kitchen table to see if that would help them go fast. It didn't help the cars go fast, but it did help me go fast when I fell over on it. So he had lots of ideas for wild and wacky inventions, mostly involving, I think, a skateboard that could take to the skies. So I very much used him in this as my basis for Al. And I confess that I've turned his brother Rob, whose interest was very much in nature, into Al's twin Lottie.
And did you have a dog like Einstein to clear up all the mess afterwards?
Well, we certainly had dogs. We had two Labradors, and one of them was not overburdened with brain. So I think she would have been a guide dog fail. So yes, the illustrator, James Brown, has done a wonderful illustration of Einstein being a very shaggy dog. but I have had dogs and I do have them in mind.
Now, Al is trying to find the best shape for a time machine that he wants to invent.
He is indeed, yes. So he's decided that he needs a time machine, partly because he is just a scientist and is interested in that sort of thing. But also his mum is rather sad because his dad has died and he thinks he'd rather like to take her back to a time when she was happy. And I'm afraid that that does have parallels in my life because my boys lost their dad when they were teenagers. So older than Al, but nevertheless, there is a certain amount of using what has happened to our family again in the book.
They take a couple of boxes of eggs.
And they do indeed. I have one box with me, Red.
It's like Blue Peter. But, here's one you prepared earlier. So take us through the experiment.
Well, Al, he is really guided often by Lottie, who has some great ideas. And Lottie says one of the strongest forms in nature is an egg. And she has all sorts of egg facts. I have actually here in my hands an ostrich egg. I'll pass it over to you to feel. It's quite cold, but it's quite hard. That's
a blown egg.
And you can feel that it's not entirely smooth the surface. Probably the size of a baby's head. And it's very, very strong indeed, because ostriches weigh quite a lot. Flightless birds, they don't have to be very light.
So, gosh, it really does have a very, very thick shell. I'd think it was ceramic if you hadn't told me it was an actual egg. It's almost as thick as a teacup, isn't it?
It is, and it's been passed round in many libraries to many children and has emerged unscathed.
Well, that's testament to just how solid and durable it is.
Mm. Apparently, ostriches, they lay in a communal nest and then they take it in turns to sit on it. So male ostriches and female ostriches, they have a whole load. So I don't know how they decide which egg is which. So she gives him the idea and then they set about trying different egg experiments to see how strong an egg actually is. And I don't know if you've tried this, but I think you will be surprised. I'm taking one ordinary, we better not advertise, egg out of a box. And you can do this over the sink. You're going to squeeze it in your hand. I'm putting it in a bag simply because we don't want it to go splat all over your keyboard. So if you hold out your hand that has no ring on it, mm-hmm. and you keep your thumb out of the equation, just squeeze as hard as you can. There's no need to hold back. You just give it a really, really, till you go red in the face.
It's not going.
It's amazing, isn't it? Try it over the sink if you're having a go at home, just in case you get a substandard egg, because we all know that we can crack eggs easily. But just hold it in the palm of your hand, stick your thumb out, curl your fingers over it, squeeze as hard as you can. Even your dad will not be able to break it.
I think I've gone puce and nothing is happening.
They are extraordinarily strong, aren't they? They really are. And if you're feeling particularly brave and have understanding grown-ups, you can put your eggs all the same way up in your egg box and then you can gently step upon it. Because I've been on the train, I haven't bought a whole load of eggs, but you can just step on it. Al and Lottie do this. They try assorted ways to see how strong an egg is. Of course, Al ends up jumping on it and they all go splat because a sudden force of weight will break an egg. So if you're going to step on your eggs and you don't want scraped off the floor omelette for tea, then just gently step up on your egg box.
Now, as we can hear from your description, the book is full of extraordinary puns. My personal favourite was the chapter called Great Expectations.
Yes, I'm afraid I had an excellent time working up some cracking puns. So, yeah, it was a joy to be able to put them in because quite often in the books that I write, I'm de-punned and they say, no, Jane, you can't have all those awful puns. But I got away with it in the Owl's Awesome Science book one, The Egg Experiments.
Well, what I loved about this book, my children are now a bit older, but it's the kind of book, as a parent, you can sit down during a long summer holidays and you can go, right, let's have some fun, but also learn something. And you go to some lengths to lay out the experiments and the results of the experiments at the end in exactly the same way that they're going to be learning at primary and secondary school.
Yes, that was the intention, that we did it correctly. I have at this point to confess that I'm not a trained scientist, although I was married to one and I have one son who is, and a lot of friends who are. I took a lot of advice on the science. I had to understand it first myself at a certain level before I could put it in these books to the level of readership that we're aiming for. So it's been a lot of fun for me. I've learnt an awful lot and realised how much more I have to learn.
And it's also teaching children that they can learn by trial and error rather than this sort of elusive perfection that I think a lot of children are now brought up with, that sometimes it does go wrong and your constant refrain is things could get messy.
Things definitely can get messy and things often do go wrong with our experiments, and he often does make the comment that perhaps he should have done it in a different way. And this is the sort of theme throughout the books, that if you want to be correct, you can use, for instance, in the blast off book, which is the third book, there's an experiment involving vinegar and baking powder, and you can be exact with it or you can get away with it. I can demonstrate that one should you wish.
Okay.
I have here some vinegar. For those of you who do like to measure things, I did previously measure it. It is 100ml in the bottle that I have. You can decant it into any small bottle or you can use it in the vinegar bottle. Red's looking a little bit nervous here. You can probably smell it as it's coming across to you. I'm going to get out a box and I'm putting a bottle that has 100ml of vinegar in the box, and then I have a balloon, and we were quite careful. We got latex balloons because we don't want to do too much harm to the planet. So this is a nice latex balloon in which there is 3 teaspoons of baking powder. Now in Al's experiment, Al just chucks as much baking powder as he can get into the balloon. What you do then is you put the neck of the balloon over the bottle. This is an experiment for Al's blast off, where he's working out how to blast off his time machine. And we like to do a countdown. So we go 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I've lifted the balloon up so that the baking soda goes instantly in it and starts with a chemical reaction to inflate the balloon. So, can you feel that, Red?
Oh, yes, it's really blowing up.
That's blowing up,
absolutely.
And you can no doubt smell This is something you do want to do over the sink, just in case it decides to erupt. But if you only use 100ml of vinegar and just the 3 teaspoons of baking powder, it doesn't get too distressing in your kitchen. So, of course, if you want it to get distressing, go outside and use more. And then you'll see that you get even bigger balloon. You can feel that again, Red. It's getting,
reasonable
size now.
Yep.
But the reaction is stopping, and so it's not going to get any further. So I'm just going to put that down on the floor out of the way, and it will just gradually
deflate.
So we did have some balloon fun within the blast off.
Now, the first book, Experiments, mm-hmm. is already in the R&IB Talking Books Library.
Yep.
And I've just been told that the second and third books are both going to be recorded.
Oh, that's very good news.
As Talking Books in this studio with the same narrator, David Thorpe, who has a terrific range of voices and I thought captured the rather prim Mrs. Good next door.
Oh, Mrs. Good, yes.
Perfectly.
Wonderful.
And I don't know whether you know, but actually the Experiments was funded by a local Talking Books Society in Westlington in the Scottish Borders.
Oh, no, I didn't know that, Red.
So clearly other people are seeing what an important book it is, and it was part of this year's Summer Reading Challenge.
Yes, the one called Blast Off was in the space race, and so I have done many of these experiments in libraries and caused people to go pale and quiver, the librarians, that is, rather than the people who were doing the experiments. because the other experiment, because it was blast off, was to do with energy and energy stored in rubber bands. So we actually made a catapult. Oh. It was a catapult that wasn't going to do a great deal of damage to anyone. And it was made out of, and I have brought the wherewithal here, a kitchen roll, three rubber bands, and a wooden spoon. What I didn't want was for people to have to go out and find weird stuff like potassium manganese and then do it. So it's very what's around the house that you can use. So I put one rubber band around the kitchen roll. It doesn't matter if it's a full kitchen roll or a half kitchen roll. And my aim is to cross the rubber bands over. So I'm putting two on and I'm making an X. You probably make more than two X, so I'm making two X's on there, but just choose one of the X's, put your wooden spoon through it under the X. I'm just going to let you have a feel of that so you can see what we've got cross over rubber band with a wooden spoon on it. I then take the third. We put it round the spoon bowl and then pull it round the handle, and that gives the extra twang.
Gotcha.
So if you have a go at that, you feel that it's got a bit of twang, but not enough to do any great damage to life or limb. And in the book, Al uses marshmallows. We had a lot of fun with marshmallows over the summer, and everybody made a catapult like that. You are putting the energy into the rubber bands, and then the rubber bands are suddenly released after you press down on the spoon. You release the spoon. The energy in the rubber bands, which is kinetic energy, is then released, and it transfers to whatever you've got in the spoon bowl to ping it across the room. So it's the same sort of energy, Lottie pointed out, in fleas. And, of course, Einstein has a flea in that particular story, which gives her the idea to what you're doing. Because a flea, their joints are such that they can jump, well, it's about 120 times their own height, I think. So if you scale that up and imagine yourself jumping over a tall building. But you can get a feeling for how fleas' joints work if you do an experiment. If you stand straight and tall and keep your legs very straight and your feet at a right angle to your legs and then try and jump, you won't get very far off the ground. But if you let everything loose and you bend your knees and bend down from a standing start and then jump, you will spring up a little bit more. And a flea's joints are designed that they can do that even more than ours can. So have a go at seeing if you can jump like a flea as well. So straight-legged and then bent-kneed.
And all of these facts are interspersed in between the chapters in your book. So the children are not only seeing the experiment being done in the chapters, but they're also recapping at the end of each chapters with some fun science facts that they can go and share with their friends.
Yes, we've done it so that if you want, you can just read the story through and not be interrupted by the details of the science. You could then go back and explore it, or hopefully we haven't interrupted the story too much with the science at the end and you can look at it there. But we also have at the back some extra experiments which are relevant to whatever story has been going on. But basically, the stories involve rather a lot of chaos and getting into trouble with the next door neighbours in different ways.
And from a parent's point of view, they also have the very sage advice that you should get a grown-up to take part as well, just so that we can check that not all the vinegar disappears in one fell swoop.
Indeed. Sadly, Al doesn't always check with his mother before he uses things, but yes, it is, generally speaking, a good policy to check with your grown-up to see if they mind you using all their eggs and vinegar and baking powder.
And is there another book on the way after Blast Off?
There is another book, and it's called Busybodies, and it explores the possible effects of time travel on the human body. So there's experiments involving spinning, which is to do with the inner ear, and also involving, sad to say, digestion. So I haven't brought the wherewithal for that, you'll be relieved to know. But basically, if you get a Ziploc plastic bag, a large one, and you put in pieces of bread, pour in some orange juice and seal it up and leave it, it will begin to digest in the same way that it does in our stomachs. Now, fortunately, Al does point this out to Mrs. Good, who's shocked. Fortunately, a person burps and farts, so we get rid of the gas. But in a sealed plastic Ziploc bag, it will build up until it bursts, or until you give it a good whack when you're outside and it goes bleh, which is rather like the same reaction you get if you vomit. It's like your muscles contracting and going together.
Thank you for not bringing that experiment in.
Yes, it is a little worrying, that one.
And one final question. I hope that it was Andrew who became the scientist.
It was Andrew who became the scientist, yes. He's an aeronautical engineer, to give him his full title.
Hopefully not experimenting with trial and error in such a messy way.
Well, do you know, I always think that when I get on a plane. It is slightly nerve-wracking.
Oh, well, Jane Clark, thank you so much for introducing us to the wonderful world of Al's awesome science, and very much look forward to the other books coming into the library and to you coming back in the future to share some more wonderful experiments with us.
Thank you. You are very welcome.
Einstein sniffed suspiciously at the green dollops on the floor. That's it, Einstein. Lick it up, Al said encouragingly. Einstein scooped up a slimy gloop with his long pink tongue and immediately spat it out. Einstein looked up at Al and wagged his tail. Al tickled him behind the ears. Yep, lettuce is yucky, Al agreed as he tried to hide the walking stick behind his back. Einstein had a thing about sticks. Too late. Einstein jumped up, clamped the walking stick between his jaws and trotted towards the open back door. Thunk! The stick caught in the doorframe. Einstein backed off. He gave the door a long, hard stare and ran at it again. Thunk!
David Thorpe narrating Experiments, Book 1 in the Al's Awesome Science series, available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB24774. For more information on the other books in the series, search rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Chris Lintott to hear the books of his life, could squeezing your bum help with giving a speech? Actor and audiobook narrator Robin Kermode is the author of a book called Speak So Your Audience Will Listen. It's packed full of great advice for how to use your voice more effectively. Robert Kirkwood started by asking Robin what voice he used for talking books.
Well, I think the main thing about using your voice in talking books is that you're talking to one person. You're not reading to 500 people or whatever. You're reading to one person. Even though 500 or 1,000 people might hear it, you're only speaking to one person. So rather like you might read a bedtime story to your child, you're trying to be very present in the moment as you're telling the story. You're trying to live the story yourself through your voice. So that requires your voice to be very authentic, which means it has to, from an acting point of view, it means it has to be emotionally connected. And for a voice to be emotionally connected, it has to be connected to your emotional center, and your emotional center is in your gut. And so as I'm speaking now, my voice is coming from my lower stomach, and I'm not talking about the pitch here, I'm talking about where it emanates from. So if, for example, I moved my voice now and I transferred it up to my throat so it was higher than my gut, I would now start talking like that. And this sort of tone that I'm using now is the sort of tone that a teacher has, and it's a slightly, who threw that, see me after class. So this tone of voice is not an easy voice to listen to, whereas if I drop it back down to where I was, it sounds very intimate and more connected.
So what differences are there, say you're doing a book for adults with adult themes or you're doing a children's book? How do you differentiate between the two?
Well, do you know, Interestingly enough, I think there's no difference, because I think the thing that I hate most is people who read children's books in a very condescending way. I find that really irritating. And one of the best children's books narration is Alan Bennett reading the Winnie the Pooh stories. And he does them so brilliantly. Martin Jarvis does the Just William books brilliantly, because there's no sense of talking down to children. There's a sense of ownership in the worries or the predicaments of the child in any situation, and so they're not saying, oh, you know, how would that be for a child, and that's rather sort of difficult, isn't it? Because actually children don't think of themselves as children. They think of themselves as real people in real situations, you know. So if you're the child hero in a children's book is saying, you know, I'm really worried about this, they are genuinely worried about it, whereas a lot of readers will put on a voice for children and they will say things like, well, I'm very worried about that, but that's not real. In the same way that if I sort of transfer it to an acting analogy, what a lot of actors do is they do what they call received acting. It's a received memory. So, for example, if they had a line in a play that was something like, they might smell the smell of a cut grass or something, and they might say, oh, I remember that smell when I was a child, and I used to walk through the lanes. But nobody actually talks in that sing-song way. They're very present, so the voice needs to be very present. So actually, what happens in real life is you take in a smell, and you go, that's exactly the smell I had when I was a child, exactly the smell. So there's something very present about it, and there's certainly nothing condescending about it.
Now, this is from an acting point of view, but how could we use this in everyday life?
Well, do you know that there's in everyday life, I'm sure you do it and I do it and all of us try not to do it, but we often have a telephone voice, for example. We might have a voice for our parents and our voice for our children and a voice when we're being angry and a voice when we're being pleasant and a drinks party voice or whatever it is, you know. And I think that in an ideal world, what we want to try to do is to use our own voice all the time. And the people that come across as being really authentic, the people we all might know, like Bill Clinton or these sort of people who have extraordinary relaxation in Nelson Mandela in the way that they speak, you get the feeling that they're being the same, that they would be the same in any situation. In other words, if you met them, or if you saw them on a stage or if you met them personally, they wouldn't be much different. Whereas most of us tend to change our voices depending on the situation we're in, and I think that leads to an element of inauthenticity.
Don't nerves play a part in that as well?
Well, nerves do, and of course where the inauthenticity comes in terms of pressured situations, it's like a job interview. It doesn't have to be a speech, you know, it could be a job interview. You can suddenly find yourself, you know, you really want this job, and therefore the nerves kick in and you find this weird voice coming out of your mouth thinking, I don't normally sound like this, and also normally my brain works better than this, but somehow it all seems to go to mush when nerves kick in. And obviously, you know, because you're a professional broadcaster, so you're used to speaking a lot, and you're also used to hearing the sound of your own voice. Which is another thing. A lot of people say they don't like hearing themselves back, or if they suddenly become self-conscious of their voice, if they're not used to it, then that can also play a part in nerves.
What else can be done to alleviate nervousness?
There's one simple trick, actually. This is just a physical trick. If you find yourself getting nervous or you find your voice shaking, one of the simple things to do, and I promise you this works, and it sounds ridiculous, but it works, is to squeeze your bottom. And I don't mean with your hand. I mean clench it. Right? That would look odd. No, I mean clench it. So if you find yourself in a slightly nervous situation, it's harder when you're sitting down. But if you're standing up, and which is when most people feel more exposed anyway, and you find your body shaking and your voice shaking, and you think my whole brain's going to mush, and people can see my nerves. If you stand there and you clench either your thigh muscle or your buttock muscle, what it does is it uses up the fight, because it's a fight or flight response. So the brain is saying, get me out of this situation, so let's start running. So it sends adrenaline and all the other chemicals to your legs and arms so that you can start running. But of course, if you don't run, they start running on their own, which is why we shake. So if you squeeze your buttocks or your thighs, it stops you shaking, and it also brings your voice down to a lower level. It tends to center your voice more and tends to stop that shaking. And I coach public speaking skills and communication skills to all sorts of people, including politicians and all sorts of things. And I love watching the news thinking, I wonder if they're squeezing their bottom at this moment, having taught them to do it.
In my early 20s, I was asked to give a best man speech at a friend's wedding. I was petrified. I couldn't understand why I felt so bad, since I was an actor and was used to standing up in front of an audience. But I realized that as the best man, I would be standing up there as myself, saying my own words, not as a character in a play saying the playwright's words. If it all went wrong, it would be my head on the block, and I hated the whole experience. So I started to look at why we feel so emotionally exposed when we give a speech.
A clip from Speak So Your Audience Will Listen by Robin Kermode, and you narrated it yourself.
I did narrate the book myself. I wrote it myself, and I obviously narrated it. Well, I didn't obviously. I mean, it's obvious to me because that I narrated it myself, because I wrote it in a way that I wanted it to speak to an audience. I didn't want it to be like a difficult manual to read. I wanted it to sound as if the reader was feeling, even if you read it, not hearing it, but if you read it, you felt I was speaking to you. And some people have said it's really weird reading it because it's literally like you're talking to me. And that's the rhythm that I tried to put into the book, and therefore it was a very easy book for me to narrate because it was my rhythms. But I narrated an audiobook of Neville Shute's The Rainbow and the Rose, and that was different because the rhythms obviously are not mine. And so you have to get into the rhythm of the writer. And eventually, it took me a little while. I obviously read it through a couple of times before I recorded it. And then I found what I felt was the rhythm, and hopefully it works quite well.
When we speak to an audience, we often put on a public mask and use a different voice. Why can't we seem to be ourselves when we give a talk? Why can we seem to connect with an audience one day and not another?
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Robin Kermode. Speak So Your Audience Will Listen is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio. Now it's back to Chris Lintott for the books of his life. So Chris, was there a book that you read as a child or young man that made you fall in love with reading?
Well, I'd always grown up reading, actually. My dad was a bookseller, so I used to run around in a large warehouse full of everything, and my childhood book collection was full of remainders with no covers. So as long as you sent the cover back, you could keep the rest of the book. But I think the thing that made me realise the possibility of writing and reading was I encountered Stephen Jay Gould's essays. There's a collection called Bully for Brontosaurus, when I was about 12, I think. And that sort of scientific writing, funny, personal, incredibly learned, suddenly made me realise that there was a way of communicating here that I wanted very much to be part of.
Bully for Brontosaurus by Stephen Jay Gould is available in print and on audio tape, if you can unearth a copy. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm not sure it's a particular book, but I've been rereading Terry Pratchett recently. So he was a guest on The Sky at Night, and we got to know each other a little bit, and he's much missed, but his view of the world is sort of funny and wise all at once, and the Discworld's not a bad place to disappear to on a rainy day.
There was no doubt that there was something magical in the soil of that hilly, broken area, which, because of the strange tint that it gave to the local flora, was known as the octarine grass country. For example, it was one of the few places on the disc where plants produced reannual varieties. Reannuals are plants that grow backwards in time. You sow the seed this year, and they grow last year. Mort's family specialised in distilling the wine from reannual grapes. These were very powerful and much sought after by fortune tellers, since, of course, they enabled them to see the future. The only snag was that you got the hangover the morning before and had to drink a lot to get over it. Reannual growers tended to be big, serious men, much given to introspection and close examination of the calendar. A farmer who neglects to sow ordinary seeds only loses the crop, whereas anyone who forgets to sow seeds of a crop that has already been harvested 12 months before risks disturbing the entire fabric of causality, not to mention acute embarrassment. It was also acutely embarrassing to Mort's family that the youngest son was not at all serious and had about the same talent for horticulture that you would find in a dead starfish. It wasn't that he was unhelpful, but he had the kind of vague, cheerful helpfulness that serious men soon learn to dread. There was something infectious, possibly even fatal, about it. He was tall, red-haired and freckled, with the sort of body that seems to be only marginally under its owner's control. It appeared to have been built out of knees.
A huge selection of books by Terry Pratchett is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including this version of Mort, narrated by Nigel Planer, which is TB10402.
And is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I found myself reading a lot of science fiction recently. I don't know, it's something about post-Brexit politics and so on that other universes suddenly appeal. Adrian Tchaikovsky's Children of Time is a stunning and wonderful book that everyone I mention it to, if they've read it, gets this gleam in their eyes. So, yeah, definitely everyone should read that. I don't want to say anything more about it because the way that it surprises you with the world that it unfurls is part of the point.
The visual acuity of a primate peers out from those pinhead-sized discs and the flexible chambers behind them, piecing together the world around her. Portia has no thoughts. Her 60,000 neurons barely form a brain, contrasted with a human's 100 billion. But something goes on in that tiny knot of tissue. She has already recognised her enemy, and knows its spit will make any frontal assault fatal. She has been playing with the edge of the Cytodes' web, sending tactile lies to it of varying shades to see if it can be lured out. The target has twitched once or twice, but it will not be deceived. This is what a few tens of thousands of neurons can do. Portia has tried and failed, variation after variation, homing in on those that evinced the most response, and now she will go about things differently. Her keen eyes have been examining the surroundings of the web, the branches and twigs that hang over and below it. Somewhere, in her little knot of neurons, a three-dimensional map has been built up from her meticulous scrutiny, and she has plotted a painstaking course to where she may come at the Cytodes from above, like a minute assassin. The approach is not perfect, but it is the best the environment will allow, and her scrap of brain has worked all this out as a theoretical exercise ahead of time. The planned approach will take her out of sight of her prey for much of the journey, but even when her prey is beyond view, it will remain in her tiny mind.
Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky is out now commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Mel Hudson. Chris Lintott, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners.
My pleasure.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.